So let me start by reminding us of what we've talked about for the last couple of weeks. We're talking about the idea of the story of the church and the story of the culture we live in. The world and the church are telling two different stories about the world, about how the world works, where we are, who we are, what's wrong, and what the solution is. And those are the four questions that any big story of all things tries to answer. And last week, what we looked at was the distinct vision of the universe. We were looking at this question of, where are we? Does anybody remember what the three important things are from Genesis 1 that Genesis 1 proclaims about the world? You could probably just guess and you'll be real close. Okay? The universe is good. It's a good place. The next one's a real softball. It belongs to God because God created the universe. Okay? And then the third one is a little harder. It was that God's own life is animating creation. That everything that lives has life because of God's own life. It's not that there's a material world that's devoid of life and somehow life mysteriously arises out of the non-life. Rather, Genesis 1 says, no, the original state of things is God's own spirit. And out of God's life comes the material world. Now, this morning, I want to stay in Genesis 1, although we're going to be in some other places. But here's the main idea that I want us to see, because I think this is one of the main things that Genesis 1 is proclaiming. It's that creation is one big temple. It's one big temple. As you're reading through Genesis 1, and you see God made the light, he separates the light from the day, and then he makes the vault, he separates the waters above from the waters below, and the dry land appears. What he's doing is he's building a house where his spirit can then come and rest, which happens on the seventh day. He takes up inhabitants, takes up residence in creation. This is God filling a house. Creation is one big temple. So, we've got a few supporting points here. First of all, the Bible depicts the temple as a miniature creation. A miniature creation. So, when you're reading in, say, the book of Exodus, about the plans for building the tabernacle, which is just a prototype of the temple. Well, it's not just that, but it is that. When you read the plans, that's like one of the hardest things about reading the Bible, honestly. If you say, I'm going to read the Bible in a year, you start off in Genesis, and things are rocking and rolling through Genesis. Genesis is a great book to read. And then you get to Exodus, and there's the plagues, and there's the Red Sea, and there's the manna, and even the Ten Commandments. But then you run into like all these chapters about the altar should be this many cubits by this many cubits, and then there's the lampstand, and there's the all of the instructions. And then there's the golden calf. That's a good little episode. And then you read all these instructions again as they built the altar this many cubits by this many cubits. And you're like, didn't I? And that's where a lot of Bible reading plans go to die. Can't we just skip that?
It's not like we're going to be building one of those anytime soon.
So what I want to suggest to you is that when you're reading the instructions for building the tabernacle, the tabernacle is designed in such a way as to mimic creation. It is a miniature version of creation. So, for example, in Exodus 31, verses 1 through 3, this is kind of right at the end of all the instructions. The Lord said to Moses, "See, I have called by name Bezalel, the son of Uri, son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah, and I have filled him with what? With the Spirit of God. With ability and intelligence, with knowledge and all craftsmanship." Something is necessary for the tabernacle to come into existence. What is it?
The
The Spirit of God is somehow empowering the creation of the tabernacle, which reminds us of Genesis 1, verse 2, which is not the last time we heard of the Spirit, but it's only like two times ago that we heard about the Spirit. When the earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. By the time you get to Exodus 33, here's the biography of God's Spirit. The Spirit was there at creation, and then the Spirit empowered Joseph to interpret dreams, and then the Spirit empowered Bezalel to create the tabernacle. I think we're absolutely supposed to see a connection. It's not that far removed from creation. And then taking the same verse, verse 3, Exodus 31, verse 3. See, I have filled Bezalel with the Spirit of God, with ability. The word ability is chokhmah. Everyone say chokhmah.
Chokhmah.
Yes, you have to clear your throat in the middle. And with intelligence, that's the word tevunah. Everyone say tevunah. And with knowledge, da'at. Da'at. All right, and all craftsmanship. Well, there's an interesting passage over in Proverbs that's talking about the creation of the world. The Lord, by wisdom, by chokhmah, founded the earth, and by tevunah, he established the heavens, and by his da'at, the deeps break open. So Proverbs describes the creation of the world as using the same qualities that Bezalel needs to create the tabernacle. Those are the only two times that those three words all appear together, which means we're probably supposed to be connecting them. So tabernacle or the temple is like a little miniature creation. Let's do some more, if my thing will work. A little bit at a time. Okay, seven times. The Lord said to Moses, the Lord said to Moses, the Lord said to Moses. Seven times. What does seven remind us of?
Completion.
Creation. And then the last of these seven speeches. By the way, this is all the times. When God is giving instructions to Moses for how to build the tabernacle, he does it in a series of seven speeches. And then the seventh speech is, the Lord said to Moses, you shall keep my Sabbaths. Seventh speech has to do with Sabbath, which the seventh day of creation has to do with Sabbath. Yeah. And then one more little bit of evidence here. Not because I know that you guys are not yet convinced, but now you will be. Okay, look at the Genesis side first. God saw all that he had made, and behold, it was very good. The heavens and the earth were completed in all their array. God finished the work that he'd been doing. He blessed it and he sanctified it, or he set it apart, made it holy. Well, as you're reading the creation of the tabernacle, after Bezalel creates everything and all these donations have poured in and it's all done, you start getting these little verbal resonances that Moses saw the work that had been done. Thus was completed all the work. When Moses had finished the work, Moses blessed them and sanctified. Do you see the connection? When you are reading about the tabernacle, it's like a little diorama of creation. Do you ever have to make a diorama when you were in elementary school, maybe? A little shoebox that looks like something larger? That's kind of what the temple is. When you walk into the temple, you're walking into a microcosm, a microcosmos. Now, this isn't a class about the temple, but I think this is going to help, because the next point is, not only does the Bible depict the temple as a miniature creation, the Bible also depicts creation as a miniature temple. As a large temple. Sorry, not a miniature. Yeah, creation just gets smaller and smaller. The Bible depicts creation as a large temple. So creation is like a big tent that God pitches. Psalm 104. This morning, Doris walked in. I gave her a hug and I said, good evening. And then I said, it's not evening. My head's not screwed on straight. It will be evening later, and it was evening recently, though. I'll give myself a little bit of a pass. All right, Psalm 104. Bless the Lord, O my soul. O Lord my God, you are very great. You are clothed with splendor and majesty, covering yourself with light as with a garment, stretching out the heavens like a tent, like a tabernacle. The heavens are stretched out like a tent. He lays the beams of his chambers on the waters. So the beams of his house are set up on out on the sea. God is making himself a little house, not a little house. He's making himself a big house. The earth is God's home. He makes the clouds his chariot. He rides on the wings of the wind. He makes his messengers winds and his ministers a flaming fire. He set the earth on its foundations so that it should never be moved. You covered it with the deep as with a garment. The waters stood above the mountains. At your rebuke, they fled. That is, the dry land appears. At the sound of your thunder, they took to flight. The mountains rose, the valleys sank down to the place you appointed. You set a boundary that they may not pass, so they might not again cover the earth. So, whole idea there, I read probably way too much to make the point, is that the creation, God is like pitching a tent. When God is making the world, it's like he's pitching a tent for himself to live in. Isaiah chapter 40, verse 22. We'll read, 22. It is he who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers. He who stretches out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them like a tent to dwell in. There are a couple of other places like this, but we're not going to spend too much time on it. But when God is stretching out the heavens, it's like he's preparing a tent for himself. Genesis 1, verse 14 and 15. This is the fourth day. God said, let there be lights. This is the word me'orot. Everyone say me'orot. Let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years, and let them be me'orot in the expanse of the heavens to give light upon the earth. This is a very, not unusual or even really specific, but this particular word for lights, it's the word really lamps. And it is used almost exclusively to refer to the lamps of the tabernacle. It's almost like, let there be menorahs in the expanse of the heavens. So when you look up at the sun and the moon and the stars, these are the lights of this large tabernacle temple that we live in. Does that make sense? Kind of. Isaiah 6, verse 1 through 3. Somebody else, if you would read Isaiah 6, 1 through 3, so that I can drink my coffee.
In the year of King Uzziah's death, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, lofty and exalted, with the train of his robe filling the temple.
Okay, pause. Pause for just a second. Where is he? Where is Isaiah when he sees this? He's in the temple, right? He sees the train of the robe filling the temple. Okay, continue.
Seraphim were standing above him, and having six wings. With two each covered their face, with two each covered their feet, and with two each flew. And one called out to another and said, holy, holy, holy is the Lord of armies. The whole earth is full of his glory.
Ah. The glory of the Lord fills the temple, and it fills the tabernacle. At the end of Exodus 40, the glory of the Lord fills the tabernacle. And when Solomon prays and dedicates the temple, the glory moves into the temple. But now Isaiah sees it's not just the temple that is full of the glory of the Lord, but holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty, the whole earth is full of his glory. The whole earth is his temple. Wherever the glory of the Lord is, that's his home. So the world is God's temple. A lot of what I've had to say to this point comes from a book by Michael Morales called Who Shall Ascend the Mountain of the Lord? It's a theology of the book of Leviticus, basically. And he has a chapter on Genesis. He says this, as the main character of Genesis 1, God is indeed portrayed as something of a workman who builds his house. He inspects it, pronounces upon his work, it is good, and then takes his Sabbath rest. The house itself, inasmuch as it is the house of God, being a temple. God's his architect, he's building his house, he inspects it, says, I like it, it's good, and then in the last day, he gives himself the certificate of occupancy, and moves in, takes up his rest. And if God lives there, God's house is, by definition, a temple. What is a temple? When you think of a temple, this is a little discussion time. What is a temple? It's a place where people would go to worship the Lord. Okay?
God's house.
It's God's house. It's where God lives.
Dwelling place.
It's God's dwelling place. Okay. An equally biblical term, dwelling place. I heard a voice over here somewhere. No?
Each one of us individually.
Okay, each of us individually. So you're thinking of like 1 Corinthians chapter 3 or 6 where it says you are the Lord's temple. The Spirit of God lives in you. Yeah. When you are reading in the Old Testament and you come across some story where they're at the temple or they're building the temple, what do you picture? First of all, you're picturing a building, right? The temple is a building. It's a physical construction. And it's God's house. Jenna said it's a meeting place, or said it's a dwelling place. I would add it is a meeting place. It is a place where the human and the divine come together. So it's, if God's space is heaven and the earth is the human space, the temple is where the two overlap. When you walk across the threshold of the temple, you're entering into heaven. You're going into God's house, which makes it sacred space. The temple is sacred space. There's a poem that I love by Elizabeth Barrett Browning. She says, "Earth's crammed with heaven, and every common bush afire with God. But only those who see take off their shoes. The rest sit around and pick blackberries."
Say that last line again.
The rest sit around and pick blackberries.
Right before that too.
Earth's crammed with heaven, and every common bush afire with God. But only those who see take off their shoes. The rest sit around and pluck blackberries. The idea, I mean, it's obviously drawing on the burning bush story. But her idea is all of creation is sacred. All of creation is a venue where you can encounter God. Not that the bush itself is God, but that all of creation is a place where you can meet with God because it's all his house. The earth is a large temple, which means that what is true of the temple is true of all of creation. What's true of the temple is true of all of creation. So what are some parallels that you see between the creation and the temple? And you're welcome to repeat things that we've already said.
Saying that it's a combo.
It's a meeting of the divine and the non-divine. It's all God made.
Okay.
And it's all by design. And what I'm just overcome with is, you know the song, "This Is My Father's World"?
Yes. Yeah. "This is my Father's world. Oh, let me ne'er forget that though the wrong seems oft so strong, God is the ruler yet. This is my Father's world. I rest me in the thought of rocks and trees, of skies and seas, His hand there mender's rod." I don't know all of the lyrics, but yeah. There's a design to the temple, and there's a design to creation. And any good astrophysicist will tell you the same thing, that there is an orderliness. What other parallels do you see between the temple and creation?
The thought while ago that I think you said he steps into his temple.
Okay.
And the fact that we are his temple, and then he steps into us, and then we are sacred.
Yeah. So you have this sort of threefold movement where when God finishes creation on the seventh day, He rests. And it's not that He lays down in a hammock and takes a nap, but it's that He's been building His command center, to change the metaphor a little bit, and once it's all done, He sits down, and now He's ready to get to business. Okay, that's the word of rest, to take up a place where the preparatory activity is now done. And we'll get to that more a lot next week. Next week we're going to talk about Sabbath. So that's the first movement. God creates, and then He sort of fills. And then the second is when He makes the tabernacle and the temple, but especially the tabernacle, when it's all done, the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. God is taking up His throne being the Ark of the Covenant, right? It's like He sits on the Ark of the Covenant in the Holy of Holies, and now He's dwelling in this micro creation. And then the third being us, that He recreates the human being by virtue of faith, by virtue of baptism, and then fills with His own Spirit. This is what Pentecost is about. He's filling us the way He filled the temple, the way He filled creation. I would add another parallel, that both creation and the temple are a dwelling place for God, who is present there but is not contained there. God is uniquely present in the temple, but He is far bigger than the temple. This is something that the prophets have to remind Israel about. And then, so he's there, but He's also bigger. And in creation, He's present in creation, but He's not contained by creation. Any other parallels that you see?
I was thinking about John 4:23, when Jesus is talking to the Samaritan woman. I noticed at the very beginning of all this, you had to go travel miles and miles to a temple, to a mountain to worship. But then Christ changed that, said, talking to the Samaritan woman, when He said, "The time will come and has come when you will not worship on this mountain or that one, but in spirit and in truth." So the location, if you will, of the temple has shifted from a physical stationary place to a mobile one, your heart.
Yeah. So it's no longer that this one building, location, mountain is the place where you meet with God, commune with God, and worship God. But it is, in a sense, can we say maybe democratized, that God's presence is spread beyond just the temple. Anywhere can be a place where you encounter God.
When you mentioned Pentecost, that's what maybe kind of cemented it for me, because He had before filled this temple, then He filled this space, now He's filled your heart. So He's in the filling spaces.
Have you ever been to a cathedral? Especially a European cathedral, but one where you just walk in and your eyes are drawn upward. It seems like it could be a waste of money to build a building that's so ornately large and fancy and gaudy. Especially when you come from Churches of Christ, where we think that frugality is like the highest of all virtues. Is there some wisdom, perhaps, in creating a physical space that recreates the beauty of creation and reminds us of the grandeur of the God that we've come to worship? I think there's some wisdom in that. It doesn't mean that I think we need to, like, dump a ton of money into this, but I see where they're coming from. Okay. Got about 10 minutes.
If it directs you towards him and not towards, oh, that's so pretty. You know, well, let's do this. But, I mean, if it is direct.
As long as the praise rolls upward.
Yeah.
Anytime I see a space like that, first thing it makes me think of is, how am I going to change a light bulb up there? I feel really small. And I'm reminded of how I'm limited and my limitations. But the person, the being I am here, the God I am here to worship is limitless. And I have to rely on him. It just reminds me of several things at once. Plus, I'm very glad I don't have a ladder to have to climb up there. But yeah.
When I was in Jerusalem, what was that, about 7 years ago, there was a group of six or seven of us, and we got a day where we went to tour around Jerusalem, and we were right next to the Pool of Bethesda, where the man who's been lame for 38 years wants to crawl into the pool. And right next to that, there's a little cathedral, not a huge cathedral, but one of these that, whoa. And man, I have never been happier to be part of a tradition where we sing a cappella, because the six of us could go in and we sang. I don't remember what we sang. I think it was just Amazing Grace, but we're able to sing in harmony and the acoustics just took over. And it was like we were participating in a very long tradition of people who have come to that building to sing, to worship. It reminded us that we're part of something bigger. Now, I don't know that there is like a living and active congregation that meets at that church on Sunday morning at 10 a.m., right? But the church is bigger than its buildings.
So. You may have already covered this. Am I running around? I missed it. But in Corinthians, Paul stresses the temple as being both individual and larger than that. And the reason they needed to understand the individual side was because their arrogance over the indwelling of God manifesting in their particular spiritual gift was the polar opposite of what that was intended to do and to be. And so they also needed to see the temple as much larger than themselves.
Yeah. Sharon brought up that the Spirit lives in us. And so we are God's temple. And in Corinthians, 1 Corinthians, Paul two separate times says, you are God's temple. And what's lost on us as we read in English is that one time it's singular and the other time it's plural. One time it's, you are the temple of God. And the other time it's, y'all together corporately are the temple of God. Okay, so what's true of the temple is true of all of creation. What that means is that everything is spiritual. Religion is not a discrete segment of our lives, where 10 a.m. to 11:30-ish is the spirit time, or from 8 o'clock to 8:15, or whenever you do, you know, some sort of quiet time or something. You know, that's my spirit time, and then that's over. If everything is God's creation, if I'm always in God's temple, then everything is spiritual. Jeremiah chapter 7. There was a Jeremiah movie that came out, I don't know how many years ago, it's got to be at least 20 years, where Patrick Dempsey plays Jeremiah. And I actually think they did a really good job, although they made 40 years look like it took about a year. So they kind of abbreviate his life. But on the whole, I endorse it. And I had to go back and watch the scene. I contemplated showing the scene of Jeremiah 7 and decided against it. But here's what it says. The word that came to Jeremiah from the Lord. Stand in the gate of the Lord's house and proclaim there this word and say, hear the word of the Lord, all you men of Judah who enter these gates to worship the Lord. Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, amend your ways and your deeds, and I will let you dwell in this place. Do not trust in these deceptive words. This is the temple of the Lord. The temple of the Lord. The temple of the Lord. For if you truly amend your ways and your deeds, and if you truly execute justice one with another, if you do not oppress the sojourner, the fatherless, or the widow, or shed innocent blood in this place, and if you do not go after other gods to your own harm, then I will let you dwell in this place, in the land that I gave to your fathers of old forever. Behold, you trust in these deceptive words to no avail. Will you steal, murder, commit adultery, swear falsely, make offerings to Baal, and go after other gods that you have not known, and then come and stand before me in this house, which is called by my name, and say, we are delivered, only to go on doing all these abominations? Has this house, which is called by my name, become a den of robbers in your eyes? Behold, I myself have seen it. I mean, it's about as clear as the prophets ever get. You come to this place and you worship. And then you walk out the door and you go to the market and you take advantage of the widow and the fatherless. You commit murder, you steal, you offer to other gods. And then you come back here and you worship and you say we're delivered. Because you don't see that everything is spiritual. You're always in my temple. Religion is not a discrete aspect of your life. The way that you treat your spouse is spiritual. I think Peter says in, I think it's 1 Peter, that if a man does not honor his wife, the Lord does not hear his prayers. Amos, I believe it's Amos, says that if you're not taking care of the poor, then God's not going to listen to your songs of praise. Everything is spiritual. If creation is one big temple, then you never leave the presence of God. Your home is part of the temple. Your home is just a room in God's temple. Your work is a room in God's temple. The market is. Online is. When you're on vacation, you're not taking a vacation away from the temple. Sometimes you're actually planning on taking a vacation toward the temple. That is, you're going somewhere where you're hoping you can find rest and encounter God. If creation is one big temple, everything you do is part of life in God's presence, which I think is why Paul says in Romans 12, do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. I think I quoted the wrong verse there, because that didn't go the way I was expecting it to. 12:1. I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. The worship is not something that happens at a particular time. Your body is a sacrifice. Your life is worship, because it's all communion in the presence of God.
Parker,
yes, ma'am.
Judaism, and I found this little man in town who was a practicing Jew, and he wasn't
You don't want it to be a discrete aspect of your life. You want it to be your life.
I'd like to read something from Leviticus. 10 verses 9 through 10.
Would you read real loud there, please?
Leviticus 9, the 10 verses 9 through 10. This is a rule binding on your descendants for all time to make a distinction between sacred and profane, between clean and unclean. God, the creation, God created the world, and it belongs to Him. But the fact of the matter is, it has fallen. We live in a broken world, and there is within that world that which is sacred and that which is profane. And I believe that the temple was constructed as a sacred creation because the world that God's people live in is a broken world, and there is things going on that are not according to God's will.
Sure. All right. Well, time just got away from us. Let me throw up my last point, that we should neither worship nor disregard creation. Creation is not an object of worship. It is not God. But neither is it something that can be thrown away. God says it is good, and it's fallen, but it's still good. Materiality is not the problem. So, there's our main point. A few ideas for homework, if you're the kind who says, I want some sort of homework to do. No accountability, there's no grading, I'm not going to fail you. But if you want to reinforce this to yourself, you might journal on some of the key ideas from today. Might set aside a sacred space in your home that reminds you that even when you're at home, you're in God's temple. Maybe you're the artsy type. You want to make a piece of art that portrays creation as a temple and maybe blends those images together. And then maybe pause while you're out running errands and remember that even now, you're in God's temple. And even now, God can be encountered. Maybe a good way to do that would be to pause in the middle of the day while you're waiting in line for your McDonald's and pray the Lord's Prayer. Okay, that is it. Next week, we're going to talk a little more about Sabbath. But thank you, guys. We'll see you in worship.